I've been to the Perimeter Institute, and I must say I'm greatly impressed by the beautiful facilities. I expect this will be a shining beacon in the theoretical physics in Canada and the world, so it's a real pleasure indeed. What I thought I would do today is discuss, in very introductory and general terms, because this is a colloquium, a little bit of the history and the modern endeavors in the study of cosmic rays. And I'll define these things as I go. So I'll briefly start by outlining what cosmic rays are, where we think they might be from, how they get to us, because that's a matter of consideration. I don't know if the screen is clear. I have issues with the interface between my laptop and the projector, so I hope you can see. So we'll be looking at clues for the origin of cosmic rays in studying the composition of cosmic rays, what kind of particles make up the cosmic ray flux, what their energies are, and what is the spectrum of cosmic rays, studying how cosmic rays propagate to us and how some of them interact along the way to produce secondary particles. And then I'll move on to discussing two specific experiments that I've been involved with. One, the CREAM experiment, which has been used to study high-energy cosmic rays by means of an experiment flown to the top of the atmosphere on a high-altitude balloon from Antarctica. So I'll talk about the Antarctic flight, the science of building an instrument like this, and all the logistical considerations. And here I made a little logo for our CREAM experiment. And none of my graduate students could recognize where I had taken this image from initially, which I thought was rather distressing. The students here are a little better versed in the classics. And then I'll move on to the highest energies with the Pierre Auger Observatory, shown here schematically, which is an array of detectors being deployed now, as we speak, in Argentina, covering some 3,000 square kilometers. So it's an enormous detector. And in both cases, we have preliminary and first results from these two experiments. Then I'll be drawing some conclusions and saying some words about where the future lay for these experiments. So first of all, the place to always go, where you can get everything, is eBay, of course. So I decided to look up cosmic rays on eBay, and this is what I came up with. Presumably, this guy is named Ray, and he does cosmic things, and these are, one would think, cosmic ray physicists. These aren't the kinds of cosmic rays I'll be discussing. Rather, I'll be discussing the kinds of cosmic rays that are high-energy nuclei or protons, running the gamut from protons to iron nuclei, and that span an enormous range in energy from about a GeV to more than 10 to the 20th electron volts. Now, I always felt impressed by this, but then, of course, I realized I'm talking to an audience of theorists here, and 11 orders of magnitude in energy isn't such a big deal for theory. So for experiments, that's quite impressive. The first thing one would want to do with cosmic rays or with particles is count how many of them there are, which is what this is. It's a spectrum of how many particles arrive at Earth as a function of the energy. And there are a number of remarkable features of the spectrum. First of all, some of the energies are quite extraordinary. Nature is capable of accelerating particles to even orders of magnitude beyond the highest energies we know to generate artificially in the laboratory. So there are clearly interesting phenomena taking place in the cosmos. This is a very rapidly falling function of energy, and the fact is disguised by using a standard trick of renormalizing the y-axis values by multiplying them by the second power of energy. So this makes a very, very steeply falling spectrum appear sort of less steep on this kind of a graph so that you can see the details of the spectrum. In particular, you see that for many decades in energy, there's a power law behavior of these cosmic rays with a certain spectral index, and it steepens beyond a particular energy to a different spectral index. So any model of the origin of the cosmic rays would have to account for that. And it's still somewhat of a mystery. If this is described to look like a leg, this is called then the knee in the cosmic ray spectrum. And there might even be an ankle down here where the spectrum changes again at the highest energies. There may even be a second knee somewhere here, and there's a little bit of a bend in that leg. So the leg analogy doesn't work anymore beyond that. So what causes the knee? And conventional thinking has it that whatever the mechanism is that's responsible for accelerating the particles to the energies we observe them to have by the time they get to us, it's probably associated with shock acceleration of supernova shock waves propagating through the interstellar medium. We know that throughout the galaxy, every maybe 100 years or so, there will be a supernova. historically, and that a lot of energy is released in a supernova explosion, and as the shockwave propagates, there's a mechanism first proposed by Enrico Fermi for accelerating a particle by having it travel back and forth across the chalk front. And there is a natural limit to the maximum energy that can be attained in this manner. And perhaps the knee has something to do with that, and I'll come back to this in a minute.
What's the evidence of that? Oh,
sorry. Well, so one clue that one would look for is studying the composition of cosmic rays as one gets closer and closer to the knee. There are specific predictions if the acceleration at supernova shock front is the real mechanism by which the cosmic rays are accelerated. There's a prediction that as you get closer to the knee, on average, you should start seeing more heavy nuclei than light nuclei. So one would look to measure the types of cosmic rays as you get closer and closer to the knee and seeing how, if at all, the composition changes. One must say that the fluxes fall very fast with energy. For instance, if one is interested in studying cosmic rays with an energy greater than a TeV, there's one such particle that crosses a square meter detector that would be in space above the atmosphere every second or so, first the radian. So one could consider building a detector flying in on a balloon or on a rocket and counting these particles. But if one pushes up in energy to 10 to the 16 and beyond, there's only one particle per year that crosses such a detector. So it's not practical anymore to study particles beyond about the knee with direct detectors in space. And of course, when one gets to the highest energies, there's now one particle per square kilometer for 100 years. So the particles become very rare indeed, and extraordinary resources have to be deployed over a very large area of ground to see particles of the highest energies with any sort of statistical significance.
Is there an understanding of the powers?
Yes, and I'll come back to this on this very slide. Thank you. So cosmic rays, we think, are generated in supernova shock waves. And here's an example of an old supernova remnant, the Crab Nebula. And we know that there are probably cosmic rays being accelerated there to this day. And if one looks at a sequence of photographs seen in the visible, in Hubble, and in the X-ray with Chandra, you see the streaming motion that's taking place. And that is consistent with the light you see is consistent with synchrotron radiation emitted by high-energy electrons that are probably being accelerated to this day, even 1,000 years after the supernova exploded, that electrons are still being accelerated there. So there is indirect evidence that supernovae may have something to do with accelerating cosmic rays. Then the cosmic rays would have to travel to get to us, and they travel through a galaxy which is permeated by magnetic fields. In other words, the particles do not travel in straight lines, but their trajectories are continuously deflected. So in understanding what happens when we look at cosmic rays at Earth, we have to account for all the propagation effects from the origin, from the source, the shock wave of the supernova explosion, all the way to us. One has to account for possible interactions of cosmic rays with the interstellar medium, magnetic fields, or radiation fields between the stars. Cosmic rays might escape the galaxy. The galaxy is like a giant magnetic bottle, but if the cosmic rays are energetic enough, they might accelerate. And they might escape, they might re-accelerate if they encounter suitable magnetic field conditions along the way. And in interacting sometimes with the thin interstellar gas between the stars, secondary particles can be produced, including particles of antimatter, including lighter nuclei. As heavy nuclei travel, they hit a proton out there, break up into smaller nuclei. So all of that physics will have to be accounted for. And then the cosmic rays reach the heliosphere, and there is this steady outgoing solar wind that the cosmic rays have to diffuse inwards against, and the low-energy cosmic rays are modulated as per the solar cycle as a result of this effect. Finally, the cosmic rays reach the Earth. The Earth itself is surrounded by a magnetic field, so that some particles are deflected back out into space if they are not energetic. Some particles are deflected towards the north and south magnetic poles, the phenomenon responsible for northern lights. Cosmic rays will also interact in the atmosphere. If you're flying an instrument above the atmosphere, that's not a problem. But if you're deploying detectors on the ground, you rely on atmospheric interactions to detect the particles. So the shock acceleration, first proposed by Enrico Fermi, which is the mechanism that will be taking place at supernova shock fronts, does naturally predict that the spectrum should be a power law. So that was your question there, Cliff. And not only this, but the kinds of exponents that are predicted by the theory are reasonable. They're about of the right value where this m parameter here is the Mach number of the shock wave. So if you read up on the theory, and the details of the theory of shock acceleration are still scant, and a lot of people are debating in the field how that takes place exactly, but it seems to be in the right ballpark. So that's another indirect bit of evidence for supernova blast waves to have something to do with cosmic rays. And as I said, there is a maximum energy to which cosmic rays can in practice be accelerated with this mechanism, and it has to do with the speed of the shock beta through the interstellar medium. The charge of the cosmic ray being accelerated, Ze, or Ze, so if it's a proton, it can be accelerated up to a certain energy. If it's an iron nucleus with a bigger Z, it can be accelerated to a higher energy. And then the average magnetic field in the accelerating region and the size of the accelerating region come into play here. So if you combine all the numbers there for the kinds of sources in the galaxy, the kinds of sites that exist in the galaxy, the practical limit is something like 100 TeV times Z. So the Ni is therefore predicted to be possibly rigidity dependent or charge dependent. Different kinds of cosmic rays, if they're iron nuclei, might be accelerated to higher energy than protons, for example.
So isn't the question what kind of energies will be confined inside the galaxy by the magnetic field?
Yes, eventually if you get to a high enough energy, cosmic rays would escape the galaxy. But this happens at energies well beyond this limit. So at 100 TeV times Z, you can still confine cosmic rays to within the volume of the galaxy. And a lot of models for cosmic ray propagation assume that the galaxy is one big magnetic box, and cosmic rays just propagate inside and bounce off the edges of the box. And that seems to reproduce a lot of the observed feature. Now, if one were to fly an instrument at the top of the atmosphere and measure the kinds of cosmic rays that arrive at Earth directly with a satellite experiment, for example, one could study the measure of protons that are not on this graph, but alpha particles, nuclei of helium atoms, all the way on up to nickel and even beyond. This graph here is arbitrarily normalized so that silicon is 100. And different points are, in red, those are cosmic rays less than 1 GeV per nucleon. In green, these are cosmic rays with 1 to 2 GeV per nucleon. And in blue are the solar system abundances that you would measure on average if you scooped up some dirt from your backyard. So there are similarities between the cosmic ray and the solar system abundances, and there are striking differences. First of all, there is this even-odd effect, this sawtooth kind of behavior, which has to do with the stability of the nuclei. The even nuclei are more stable, and therefore they tend to be more abundant. They are not broken down in interactions as much. One can readily discover that certain elements are in greater abundance than the others. For example, helium nuclei, carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, neon, magnesium, silicon, and iron tend to have higher abundances than the other elements. So that's a result of the stellar nucleosynthetic reactions that generated them in the first place. And when one flies an instrument to detect the composition of cosmic rays, one looks for peaks for these particular elements. And you'll see with the data we got from this CREAM instrument that we flew in a balloon, we see these peaks readily stick out. But there are striking differences, and there are certain elements that are just not present in the solar system in great numbers because they are not produced by nucleosynthetic reactions. And yet, in cosmic rays, those elements are present in a far greater proportion. And this is because, in cosmic rays, there are elements that travel through the galaxy for millions of years. They can run into a nucleus out there in the thin, dilute gas between the stars, and spallation reactions can break up nuclei into lighter nuclei that are just not normally present in the solar system. Now, the study of these kinds of secondary cosmic rays, such as beryllium, and the relative proportion of beryllium to carbon gives us a handle on the history of the propagation of the cosmic rays, because these beryllium nuclei are largely produced by the breakup of carbon, nitrogen, and oxygen. Studying the secondary to primary ratio, which is what is being plotted here as a function of how that changes with energy, gives you a handle on various propagation models, and the various curves are various models with different diffusion parameters for the propagation of cosmic rays through the galaxy. And depending on how the cosmic rays propagate and how long they stick around, then they can interact more or less and produce more or less secondary nuclei. So measuring the boron to carbon ratio is an indirect way of determining the parameters of cosmic ray propagation.
Yes, please. I'm just curious, how do you determine the composition of the primaries?
You'll see in a minute. I'll describe in detail an experiment we put together to do just that. You have to put an instrument above the atmosphere and see every cosmic ray coming through and identify the charge of the cosmic ray and count how many there are and measure its energy. So it's a tricky business, especially as you go up in energy. These get to be rapidly very, very energetic particles. So the expectations under the shock, supernova shock acceleration mechanism is that protons would be accelerated. This is now rescaled by a different power of e to the 2.75. And protons would be accelerated up to a certain energy, but eventually the flux would be depleted. And alpha particles could be accelerated to slightly higher energies. And eventually iron nuclei could be accelerated to higher energies still before they start being depleted. So that if one were to measure how the composition changes as one approaches the knee, one could see compositional changes that would be the indication of this rigidity-dependent acceleration model for supernova shock waves. So this is one of the hints we're looking for. As of now, this is a busy slide that illustrates direct measurements that have been made of proton fluxes as a function of energy, helium nuclei fluxes, and iron fluxes as a function of energy. And in each case, there are some direct measurements, roughly in this energy range, this energy range, this energy range, done with high altitude balloon experiments or satellite experiments. And beyond that, one has to resort to indirect techniques. One has to deploy air shower detectors on the ground, because the particles become too rare, and one has to look at the end results of a lot of atmospheric cascade processes and try to extrapolate that back to the top of the atmosphere, which is very model dependent. The reason I'm showing this is to indicate that the direct measurements, first of all, especially for the heavier nuclei, become quite scattered. The error bars are large because the fluxes go down very fast with energy. It becomes very difficult to make the measurement. So clearly, there is a need for improved direct measurements at these energies. And if one did this with an experiment such as the CREAM experiment I'll be telling you about in a minute, if one makes better measurements, this then becomes an anchor point, a known composition for the higher energy studies that are done with indirect techniques such as air shower instruments. And currently, there are, for example, Cascada results. This is an air shower array in Germany that has been doing a lot of studies. The ESTOP experiment used to be in Italy. And these indirect studies have large uncertainties due to uncertainties with the model calculations. For example, some models of particle interactions use the QGS jet CERN model. Other models use the CIBIL algorithm that was developed over the years and other as well. There's a lot of particle physics uncertainty in these models that result in great uncertainty here in the range of the individual spectra. So having better measurements at these energies to anchor the higher energy measurements will be of importance. And when one talks about doing compositional studies with an experiment like Auger, which I will also discuss later, this goes an even further 3 orders of magnitude beyond the edge of the graph. If there's that much uncertainty here at these energies, who knows what's going on at the highest energy. So clearly, anchoring better the measurements at the lower energies is a good idea. So I'm involved with 2 different experiments. One of them is this CREAM experiment, which is supported by NASA in the United States. And with this instrument, we are measuring cosmic rays in this energy range with, in the particular first flight configuration, and I'll talk about the first flight in a minute. And with repeated flights of the instrument, we can push up the energy up to here or so if we get the full 200 days of exposure we're looking for. So we're going to be measuring cosmic rays directly almost all the way up to the knee, where one would expect to start seeing changes in composition. So the idea is to make direct measurements of cosmic rays over an energy of about 1 TeV to 1,000 TeV. We have to be able to identify individually the nuclei coming through. We have to be able to tell a carbon nucleus from a nitrogen nucleus. And to do this, we go to Antarctica with our balloons, because by flying around the Antarctic continent, where the sun shines on the payload 24 hours a day, we can have solar panels to power up our instruments. We can have the balloon stay at relatively constant altitude for 24 hours at a time. So we can get much longer flights than going at intermediate latitudes where the sun could set the instrument. So Antarctic is the place to go for these measurements. We also measure the energy with two different techniques on board so that there's some cross-calibration. After all, these are energies of about Tevatron experiments here. And if you think about it, we don't have the luxury of a city block size detector like people do these days at accelerators. We have to have something that can fly. So there's quite a bit of need for doing as much cross-calibration and redundant measurements as possible. So the target of this experiment is to have a total exposure of 200 days from Antarctica with an instrument that has an acceptance of about 2.2 meters squared per radian. And then I'll also be discussing the highest energies, which is where the Pierre Auger Observatory comes in the United States. This is funded by NSF and DOE, but this is a large international project with a lot of different countries involved. So at these energies, the measurements are indirect. What we see are the interactions of the cosmic rays in the atmosphere, and the idea is to measure the spectrum at the end of the cosmic ray flux, beyond 10 to the 18 eV or so, and to look for possible anisotropies in the arrival directions of cosmic rays. Cosmic rays are deflected by magnetic fields, but if they become energetic enough, their trajectories are not deflected significantly anymore by the time you get to a few 10 to the 19 eV. So it's possible that by the time they get to us, the particles point back to their origin, their source of origin. There's a possibility of identifying neutrinos. I probably won't have time to talk about this. Possibly some sensitivity to composition at these energies, but that's still TBD. We have some preliminary information there, but nothing definite yet. So the Pierre Auger project is a giant air shower array, still under construction in Argentina, and we use a hybrid technique. We use two different techniques simultaneously, and I'll explain all this in detail. So going to the CREAM, Cosmic Ray Energetics and Mass Balloon Experiment, this is a complicated particle physics experiment that flies to about 120,000 feet using scintillation detectors at the top and bottom of the instrument, a transition radiation detector, a silicon charge detector, graphite carbon targets for creating particle cascades, scintillating fiber otoscopes, and then at the bottom a tungsten silicon fiber, scintillating fiber calorimeter. So it's a complex particle physics instrument that does physics at LHC or at least at Tevatron energies, but yet is light enough to fly in a high altitude balloon. And here's the photograph of the instrument we built with a person here shown for scale. So the instrument weighs some 3,500 kilograms. And you see all the various particle physics detectors buried beneath racks of electronics. So very quickly, we have these timing scintillator at the top. Here's an exploded view of the instrument. And with these scintillators, we measure the charge of the cosmic rays coming through. When the particles travel through the thin scintillators up here, they ionize the material such that the amount of light generated is proportional to the square of the charge of the particles. So we digitize very quickly the signal generated in the scintillators, and it turns out that we are able, and I'll show this in a minute, to reconstruct the charge of the nuclei with a resolution of better than the charge unit. So we can really tell elements apart from each other. The transition radiation detector is shown here in cross-sectional view. What we do here is we use the fact that as particles travel through a foam matrix that sensitive tubes are embedded in, beyond about 1 TeV per nucleon, the energy loss is also accompanied by transition radiation. So there's an enhanced energy deposit. I'll show the curve in a minute. So that by measuring the signals in these tubes inside the foam matrix, we get a measurement of the Lorentz factor of the particles, and hence the energy gamma of the particles. So this is a device for measuring the energy of the particles. And at the same time, we map the hits in three dimensions in two views to reconstruct the trajectory in space of the particles.
So you identify the elements, you can identify the isotopes too?
No, not the isotopes. That's too hard to do at these energies. So we identify the elements. That's the best we can do at this point. We have a plastic Cherenkov detector here that helps in flagging relativistic particles that yield the Cherenkov signals, whereas the non-relativistic particles don't. And when you fly at Antarctic latitudes, the magnetic field of the Earth causes a lot of low-energy particles from the sun to be present. And we want to remove those low-energy backgrounds. You'll see these in a minute. We have a silicon pixel detector with the pixels being about 2 square centimeters each. And with these, closer down, these detectors closer down to the calorimeter, we're able to get a redundant measurement of the particle charge with, again, a small fraction of a charge unit. So we have multiple redundant measurements. We have scintillating fiber otoscopes, photographed here at a test at CERN. There are three of those where we track the particles coming through. We get yet one more redundant measurement of the charge as well, plus they are used in triggering and tracking the particles. We have graph-like targets amounting to a total of about half of an interaction length. So as the cosmic rays come through, we try to get them to interact in here so that then we can look at the shape of the shower in the calorimeter down here. So at the bottom, we have this calorimeter consisting of 20 plates of tungsten, each one radiation length thick. And interspersed between the tungsten planes are fiber layers. So we read the longitudinal shower development in the calorimeter to get an energy measurement of about with resolution of about 45%. So we measure the energy here and here. We measure the charge up here, over here, over here. We trigger using these various signals. So there's multiple complementary particle detection techniques brought to bear. So when everything is put together, it looks like this. The detectors are here. At the bottom, we have transmitters and NASA systems for communicating from the ground with the payload. Also, when the payload drifts beyond the horizon, which takes a few hours after launch, we then communicate with the payload using the TDRS NASA satellite relay network. So this equipment down here deals with all that. And we have solar panels so that the instrument can be powered 24 hours a day. When we fly during the local Antarctic summer, the sun shines on the payload 24 hours a day. So we have to operate all these particle detectors with a total power budget of 400 watts. It's not a lot. And these large solar panels provide us with that. The instrument is about 1,300 kilograms, including the whole structure, the solar panels, the transmitters, and everything at the bottom. So it's a real challenge. All of that operates in the near vacuum of space. You have to worry about the detectors and any high voltages across narrow gaps causing discharges at these low atmospheric pressures of a few millibars. You have to worry about things not overheating when the sun shines on the payload. You have to radiatively get rid of the heat. So it's a real challenge to get everything to work. Then you have to go down to Antarctica. And the way you go down to Antarctica is you fly to Christchurch, New Zealand. And then they outfit you with, I think I counted 11 pairs of gloves and thermal socks and Canadian-made parkas and giant bunny boots. And then they put you on a C-130 transport plane, shown here, and they fly you from New Zealand to McMurdo Station on an island just off the coast of Antarctica, and your equipment is shipped separately.
You said you're doing it there because you want 24-hour sunlight.
That's right. They've tried that, and Russia won't let you fly over their territory. So that's a problem. So they do fly from Sweden to Canada. That's the best they can do right now. They've been trying to negotiate with the Russians for years. At these energies, the particles are not deflected much by the Earth's magnetic field. But for the galactic magnetic fields, integrated over the large scales, they become significant. But at these energies of TeV and above, there isn't much of an effect that we worry about there.
So if you could do these things in orbit, would it be easier?
It would be better. Yeah, but you'll see, I'll show a video in a minute of a balloon launch. It's a very gentle way to launch a detector. If you put a detector like that on a rocket, you have to do all these shake tests, and it's a lot more expensive. And it costs about 1,000 times as less to fly a balloon than to fly a space shuttle, for example.
Yeah,
when the space shuttle
short.
Flies.
Yeah. The shuttle, sure.
Well, that's expensive as well. Yeah. Every time you look at a rocket, it's $100 million easily. So we don't have the budgets for that. So this is McMurdo Station on Ross Island off the coast of Antarctica. So at the time we went there, the ice had largely melted. So you see all the dirt and the ash that is around. And you still have structures built 100 years ago by Sir Robert Falcon Scott and his men that are still around today. Nothing rots in Antarctica. So all these old structures built by the early explorers are still there. But the base is here. It's a research base. So everybody there is either a research scientist or a support person who cooks and cleans the toilets and such, or an Air Force person who flies the planes in and out. And there are about 1,000 people there at the height of summer, and maybe 100 or so during winter.
How long a flight is it from
Christchurch? It's about 8 hours from Christchurch to McMurdo, and about half the time, you don't make it in one trip. You fly halfway, and the weather goes bad very quickly, you have to fly back. and then try again a couple days later. And you sit in these military transport planes, you sit in cargo webbing in the back. There's no cabin soundproofing, so everybody's wearing earplugs, so everybody's sitting there not talking for 8 hours. And sometimes
so it's not a movie flight.
No, there's no in-flight entertainment.
So how often do you do this?
Once a year, so far we went down twice, and I'll show a video of that. They have these interesting looking vehicles, actually made in Canada. This is a Terra bus. This one is Ivan the Terra bus. That shuttles back, that's what they called it, it says on the side. This is Mount Erebus. It's the southernmost active volcano in the world. It happens to be on Scott Island. And it's always in a lot of the pictures out in the background. It's about 30 kilometers away. And the air is so clean down there that you feel you could just reach out and touch it. It's amazing. There's always a little bit of smoke coming out the top. So it's an active volcano. And there's wildlife down there. And the rule is you can walk as close as you want, provided they don't react to you. The seals don't react to much of anything. So you can usually walk quite close, and they just sun themselves and ignore you. Penguins are a different story. But if they start reacting to you, then you're too close. You have to back off. This is a Weddell seal. And this is inside one of these huts that Scott had built 100 years ago. You can get the key from the local firehouse and go in there, and you promise not to touch anything. So that's all left over. So I thought it'd be interesting to show a flight of the balloon launch from 2004, where we went. This is the heat, the cream detector. Here's a Penn State sticker. And that gets picked up now on the day of the launch by this enormous crane that was set down there. And then the crane is going to drive out to a launch pad that's been prepared on the runway. It's about 2 or 3 in the morning, and it's broad daylight, of course. So it's kind of a strange place to be with the sun shining 24 hours a day. Here's Mount Erebus in the back. So now they're positioning everything to match the surface winds. And the detector is hanging from the crane here. And this trailer has all the cylinders of compressed helium gas that will then be pumped into the balloon. The NASA technicians are deploying a parachute. It's a nylon parachute. They're deploying it down on the runway. And in a minute, they'll be taking out the balloon, laying it down. It's an enormous balloon. It's about 13 acres of fabric for one balloon. 24 miles of seams that have to be thermally glued, and the balloon itself is about the thickness and consistency of a dry cleaner bag. It's this very thin material that, yet, when fully inflated, is 48 million cubic feet, 5 times the volume of the Hindenburg. So the balloon is deployed on the runway here, and way over there is the crane with our payload hanging from there. So here we're going to pan from the crane all the way to the balloon being inflated. So that's the rigging and the parachute, and then the balloon lays flat on the runway. And the balloon starts here, and this is the balloon, and the balloon, and the balloon, the balloon, and 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 the balloon. And eventually the tip of it is wound around a spool on a big truck, and the very tip of the balloon is what's being inflated. There are filled tubes through which the helium is being pumped, and when all the gas has been pumped into the balloon, the spool is going to lift up, allowing the balloon to be released and to start rising. And you'll see it's a very gentle launch. When it picks up the instrument, there's hardly a jolt to it. So you can afford to fly delicate detectors and not be worried that they're going to be destroyed by the shaking at launch. So the wind catches on the payload. They have to wait for very low wind conditions before they can fly these things. In Antarctica, that's very tricky to achieve. So you can sit there sometimes for weeks without good launching conditions. And you see the parachute is being picked up. And when the whole thing is vertical, the crane is going to start driving to match any residual surface winds so that when the payload is let go, it's as gentle as possible. So you'll see in a second they're going to let it go. And you always get a little pinch in your heart when you watch it go, because you never know if you'll see it again. There are all kinds of horror stories I could tell you over a beer. So you see various antennas here, ballast hoppers at the bottom. And this being a NASA launch, you'll see in a second, as this thing goes up, pieces of foam debris falling. That's actually protective material wrapped around the balloon to protect it so it doesn't tear on launch. So this goes up very gently. It takes about 3 hours to rise up to about 40 kilometers. And at that point, it'll be above 99 point some percent of the atmosphere.
So
So why do you need the huge distance between the balloon and the payload?
Because as the whole thing rises through the atmosphere, the decreasing atmospheric pressure will cause the balloon to inflate. And in a second, you'll see several shots at different altitudes.
18,000 feet.
Thank you. 18,000 feet. So you see that the balloon has started inflating more. And in a second, you'll see it from the ground. Even when it's at 40 kilometers of altitude, you can still see with the naked eye.
And the payload is now at 105,000 feet.
And you see it quite well. And when we fly these things from places like New Mexico, people call the sheriff because they've spotted a UFO. In Antarctica, there's not too much of that.
What's the failure rate on the launch?
What's the what? Failure rate? In Antarctica, they've had a very good success rate. It's expensive enough to go down there that they make sure they only launch when the wind conditions are good. But from mid-latitudes, they're willing to take a little more risk. And they also launch more payloads per campaign. In Antarctica, they only launch 2 payloads a year. So the failure rate is higher. It's probably 1 in 4 or 5. But the failure usually is not catastrophic. Sometimes the balloon rips, and they're able to detach the parachute and let the payload land and get recovered.
What's the outdoor temperature while this
was? At the ground, it wasn't bad that summer. It was hovering near freezing. When the wind picks up, it gets cold very quickly. But these payloads are only launched when there is no wind, so it wasn't bad. It was near freezing. So here's a animation of the trajectory for that particular flight. We launched it from McMurdo. It went around once. Everything looked good. So we let it go around a circuit orbit. It actually drifted in close to the pole, and it really slowed down. So we had a good long flight. We even let it go for a third orbit, which had never been done before. Then it went out over the sea. We thought we'd never see it again. And at the last minute, it just swung back over ice, so a recoverable position. So we landed it. And as a result of this, we had the world record flight duration for a payload of 42 days in orbit. So this is the longest flight ever. And that was in 2004 and 2005.
Did you recover it?
We recovered it in the same season. We sent out, I'll show pictures of recovery in a second. While the instrument was in flight, we monitor things remotely from the ground. So we can monitor the health of the instrument, adjust thresholds and such of the instrument. And here's an example of a 10 TeV iron nucleus that came through and deposited large ionization in the TRD counters, a large signal in the scintillators up here, a shower in the calorimeter, and we're in the process of reconstructing all these events. And at the end of the flight, the parachute deploys automatically, the balloon is detached from the parachute, the instrument lands and usually keels over on its side, but without too much damage, we were able to send out a recovery crew with a Twin Otter plane, and we have 3 or 4 people camping out on the ice for 5 days. The plane just leaves them out there and flies away. They set up camp, and they dismantle the instrument, and then they come back with the plane and take back the instrument in pieces. So just to give you an idea, this is a plot of events recorded in flight with signals in the Cherenkov counter versus signals in the scintillator at the top of the instrument. And you clearly see populations of events where the darker clouds, carbon, nitrogen, and oxygen, are commensurate with the higher abundances that I mentioned before. However, there is this low-energy tail of events in Antarctica due to the low magnetic fields that we have to worry about. So we have a number of cuts on the other instruments to get rid of these tails. And when we do all this, we get good intrinsic charge resolution, especially for doing things like secondary to primary measurements. The boron nuclei were produced in the interstellar medium. The carbon nuclei came directly from the supernovae. And we have to eliminate low-energy backgrounds. And this is the kind of...
Is this charge, not charge per mass?
This is the total charge of the nucleus coming through, but these are naked nuclei. There are no electrons in there. So we know that these are what the elements are here. And here is a preliminary distribution of charges, and you can clearly see the individual elements being separated from each other, including the fluorine peak, which nobody has seen at these energies before. This is clearly the best energy reconstruction any direct measurement, any direct payload has been able to achieve. So we're in the process of reconstructing the energies of all the nuclei there that you see, where the charge identification is really where we wanted it to be at this point. And here's a preliminary distribution of energies deposited in the calorimeter. The good news is it looks like a power law, which is what we expected it to be. So, but what the exact value of the abscissa here should be, we're still working on. It requires a lot of Monte Carloing and understanding of the interactions inside the calorimeter detector planes. But we have this cross-calibration with a transition radiation detector, and here is a series of measurements done at CERN of the transition radiation detector response with radiator present when there is transition radiation or with no radiator. And I'm sorry, these are simulations and the points are actual measurements. So we think we understand the shape of this function very well. We can use the measured transition radiation signal to determine the Lorentz factor gamma for the particle, enhance the energy of the particle. So that's how we make that measurement. And having done this, here are some preliminary results just shown this past summer for the first time of measurements of oxygen spectra and carbon spectra obtained with the blue points are obtained with our Cherenkov counter, and the green points are obtained with the TRD. The energy is obtained. And older measurements shown here of the HEAO satellite experiment and the CRN experiment that flew on the space shuttle are shown. These were the highest energy measurements prior to us. And we have measurements that are in good agreement with them, albeit with so far an arbitrary flux normalization. We're still working on the details of the energy reconstructions and such. But this band here is a region where we have measurements. This is where the transition radiation kicks in at this particular energy. And the size of the band is indicative of our error bars at this point. So we haven't finished placing our points with this first flight within that band, but we know that they fall in here. So we're clearly extending the measurements an order of magnitude beyond the highest energy measurements so far. And although error bars are not shown here, our error bars will be much smaller than has been achieved previously.
You said that's an arbitrary normalization. Does that mean that the fact that the two curves match up is not significant?
Now, our curve was normalized to, I think, one of the HEAO measurements here for now, as we're still understanding the efficiency of our detectors.
But you have some idea of the total number of nuclei.
We know the total number of nuclei we detected,
yeah.
But going from that to the actual number of nuclei that came through is what takes effort, because you have to understand.
What's this total number that you detected?
I'll give you the numbers. I don't have them on the slide, but it's in the many hundreds of these energies, many hundreds of nuclei of each species.
What is meant by transition radiation?
Transition radiation is a phenomenon, an electromagnetic radiation that occurs when a particle goes through a repeated series of dielectric interfaces. So if you imagine a dielectric surface and a particle approaching that, there's an image charge that forms. And as the two move relative to each other, you generate radiation. So there's an additional radiation that's produced that wouldn't be there if you didn't have these repeated interfaces. And in fact, the pioneer of this technique, Dietrich Mueller, is a close friend and collaborator of ours, and it's been used many, many times successfully. Here's another result from the heat experiment. I keep saying heat, that's an older balloon experiment, the cream experiment, which is the average log A, where log A is the number of nucleons in the nuclei, so the average nucleon mass as a function of energy, where the older measurements on average are shown here. In reality, they scatter a lot. But the average band is shown in yellow, and our measurements are shown in blue and red with two different analyses within the collaboration, and we're still finalizing that. So at this point, we have measurements that are compatible with the older measurements, but that extend much higher than the previous direct measurements. And the points at higher energies are all from indirect techniques using air shower arrays. So we're clearly going beyond what had been done before, and we're still finalizing these points, so at this point, this is not publishable, but it's where we've gotten to. The flight I showed was from 2004-2005. In 2005-2006, we returned to Antarctica with a different payload. We built a duplicate of it, except it didn't have a TRD in the middle. It was not ready in time for this flight. It's hard to build these things. So we flew a partial instrument. So the science reach of the second flight of this instrument is more limited than the first one. But meanwhile, NASA had upgraded the facilities in Antarctica, including now indoor bathrooms. Previously, they had only this part of potty outside, which, you know, in Antarctica is a problem. So in 2005-2006, we went back, and we had the third longest flight this time. We went twice around the continent. We had 28 days of exposure. So if you add the two flights together, we had at 70 days of total exposure. We were shooting for a total of 200, so we're a good fraction of the way there. We have also recovered the payload from the second flight, And we're in the process of refurbishing our first payload to fly it again, not this year, but next year. Now, moving on very quickly to the highest energies, because this is what we've been doing with direct measurements near the meat. At the very highest energies, one could look at similar acceleration mechanisms of magnetic field, turbulent magnetic field regions, and shock waves somehow accelerating cosmic rays. And the same limitation that I mentioned before, the maximum energy that a cosmic ray could be accelerated to, applies here. And this is a distribution due to Michael Hillis of the scale size of accelerating objects in the universe versus the expected magnetic field strength on average that one can expect to find in these objects. So interplanetary space is here, the Crab Nebula remnant is here, sunspots are over here. And the thing to realize is because of this limitation on the maximum energy, if one is interested in coming up with a mechanism for accelerating a 10 to the 20th EV proton, we would have to come up with an object that is somewhere above that diagonal line. If the 10 to the 20th EV objects that have been observed are iron nuclei, it would have to be an object that is above the diagonal line. So we're looking at extreme kinds of objects. The Crab Nebula remnant would not be an accelerator that could reach the kinds of energies we're talking about for the highest energies.
What's IGM?
Intergalactic medium down here. So it's very big, but very low field. The problem with this distribution here is it doesn't take into account likely radiation fields that are present in any of these acceleration regions. And if you try to accelerate a particle in the magnetic A star, and you try to get it to accelerate for a while, as it's being accelerated, it interacts with the radiation fields that are present. So if you account for things like the synchrotron losses and photoreactions, most of the sources go away. You just can't accelerate particles if you subject those sources to realistic limits. The one source that still survives, seemingly, are radio galaxy hotspots. Here's an example. I'll show an example in a second of a radio galaxy hotspot. But because these objects that survive are at very large distances, it's likely that the sources of these ultra-high energy cosmic rays will be extragalactic. And somebody asked about having the cosmic rays rotate and be trapped by the magnetic fields at these highest energies, near 10 to the 20th eV. No magnetic fields within the galaxy are sufficient to trap the cosmic rays. So if they were produced within the galaxy, they would escape. And therefore, the ones we observe are likely to be from outside the galaxy. These acceleration ideas are bottom-up scenarios, where you take a particle, you accelerate it, and get it to have higher and higher energies. Because it's so difficult to do, and there's only one candidate left, people have been speculating that there may be other particle physics processes that are taking place to generate particles at these extreme energies. And I'll show an example in a second. But I mentioned radio galaxy hotspots, or here's one, 3C353, which is 420 million light years away, is an object that has a central engine, jets of relativistic particles shooting out from it, and some distance away, some 91,000 light years away from the central engine, there's these globes that glow strongly in the radio at radio frequencies. So there are interesting processes taking place. There could be turbulent particle acceleration taking place here, and at the same time, reduce radiation fields that would allow the particles to escape. So these could be the sources of the cosmic rays at these energies. Unfortunately, these sources are very far away. 130 megaparsecs is too far away because the cosmic rays have to get to us, and at these energies, the universe is no longer transparent. The cosmic rays have to plow through the cosmic microwave background. So these are the only sources we know of currently that could, in principle, meet all of the requirements for accelerating particles, but they seem to be too far away.
So it's
a mystery. I'm sorry?
Do we know it's a proton? Are we sure?
We don't know what they are. We don't know if they're protons or iron nuclei or magnetic monopoles, and we don't know what they are. We know that the shapes of the showers they generate in the atmosphere seem to be reasonable compared to simulations of what a proton or an iron nucleus would do. So it's likely that they're atomic nuclei. We know at the lower energies that the cosmic rays are nuclei, but at these energies, we are fairly certain they're not all photons. They're not all gamma rays, because the shape of the showers in the atmosphere would be very different. And in fact, with the Auger Observatory, we have a limit on how many of these could be photons at this point. So some of the top-down scenarios, where some exotic particle physics is taking place to generate these particles, there's one where topological defects are surviving somehow from the primordial universe, and as a result of this, they can decay, generating particles at really ridiculously large energies. We get to the realm of stupid exotic Greek prefixes like iota electron volts. So nobody's ever seen particles at zeta iota electron volts. But if this model is correct, in principle, there could be particles at these energies. And also, interestingly, the prediction is that the spectrum should be dominated by neutrinos. And nucleons would be down here, and gamma rays possibly here. So there's a prediction. There are exotic particle physics models like this. And all of them have problems. Something like this would result in a completely isotropic arrival direction for the cosmic rays. If we start seeing an isotropies instead, then perhaps there are sources that one has to look at in a bottom-up kind of scenario. So this is what we're looking for. And I mentioned interactions of cosmic rays with a microwave background. This leads to the prediction of a Grison-Zetsepin-Kuzmin cutoff, a GZK cutoff, which is if, for example, a cosmic ray started out at 10 to the 22 electron volts, as it travels through the universe, it plows through the microwave background, interacts with it. This is above the threshold for photopion production. And the nuclei, or the cosmic rays, get degraded. They interact. Their energy is reduced. And they can only propagate a short distance. So for example, if the cosmic rays start at 10 to the 20th eV, 50% of them would have to come from 20 megaparsecs, which is the real local cosmological neighborhood. The kinds of sources I was talking about, the radio galaxy hotspots, are much further away than this. So there's a problem. It's hard to account for how the particles are created and how they get to us. There are multiple problems. If the sources are indeed nearby because of this argument, you would expect to see anisotropies. You would expect to see arrival directions of these cosmic rays point to certain places in the sky. And as a result of the expected interactions of these particles with a microwave background, you would expect there to be neutrinos produced. So there can be neutrinos produced if the topological defects are responsible. There can be neutrinos produced even if more modest bottom-up scenarios take place. So to detect those ultra-high-energy cosmic rays, one can deploy counters on the ground and look for the interactions in the atmosphere of all the secondary products that are produced when the cosmic ray hits a nucleus up at 12 or 20 kilometers. Literally, billions of particles will be produced. So you could detect them by deploying detectors on the ground and detect a shower front when it hits the ground. This is a technique most recently used by the Agassa experiment in Japan, which has accumulated a total data set corresponding to 2,000 square kilometer years to radian of exposure. The alternative is to look on dark nights to the side of the air shower for the excited sky glow, nitrogen fluorescence of the air shower crashing down through the atmosphere. And this technique has been used by the HIRES experiment, which is still finishing up operations now, has accumulated a total exposure comparable to Agassa. So these are the two most recent experiments prior to Auger that have been measuring cosmic rays at these giant extreme energies. So Agassa, here's one detector from Agassa, scattered over 100 square kilometers, has measured a spectrum of cosmic rays, rescaled by the third power of energy as a function of energy, shown as the points here. And the dashed curve here is a prediction of what the spectrum should look like if sources of cosmic rays are distributed uniformly through the cosmos and the GZK cutoff effect comes into play. So you should expect some pileup from the higher energy particles getting degraded to these energies. And the surprise is there are some 10 or so particles beyond that cutoff. So it looks, if on the face of this, that there is no evidence for the GZK cutoff that was predicted in 1966. So that's a bit of a puzzle. But in contrast to this, the HIRES experiment, which looks at the desert sky in Utah at night with detectors arranged around two rings, here's one of them, has seen this spectrum. The points in black and red are their spectrum, and they think they see evidence for a cutoff here. They think they see that they certainly don't agree with the Agassa points shown in blue. There's a difference in normalization, which could lead to a difference in the energy reconstruction of these two experiments, because this is rescaled by EQ. So if there's an energy difference, it gets built into this. But HIRES claims that they have seen the cutoff. So there's a discrepancy between the two results. The HIRES people have been claiming that perhaps the Agassa energies were overestimated. And certainly there are large uncertainties in the energies, because all of this is model dependent. You rely on simulations of what happens in the atmosphere. And if you were to take the Agassiz points in blue and rescale the energies down by 20%, you get the green points, which agree completely now with high res, with perhaps a couple of points here, but the error bars are large enough that statistically the difference is not significant. So maybe that's what's happening. Maybe Agassiz got it wrong. Their energies were reconstructed wrongly. However, the Agassiz people have been quick to point out that the fluorescence technique has its own pitfalls as well. Understanding the amount of light that's generated as a shower crashes through the atmosphere is very difficult. And there have been different measurements over the years, and that folds into reconstructing the energies from the fluorescence signals, and there are large uncertainties there as well. So clearly this called for a better instrument to come and make this measurement once and for all, and that would be Auger. Another bone of contention between the two is in looking at the arrival direction of the seen cosmic rays at these energies. Agassiz claims that they've seen clusters of particles that are not compatible with chance. In one case, they claim that this triplet of events of a certain direction in the sky had only less than a 1% probability of occurring by chance. Moreover, Agassiz reported an excess from the vicinity of the galactic center at a certain energy. They saw 22% more events than they expected at a level that was statistically significant. I think it was 5 sigma. So they claim they saw perhaps preliminary evidence for point sources. IRAS disagreed with this.
How many points do they have in that graph?
Perhaps 150 or so.
So 1% is not so unlikely.
It's not terribly unlikely. And the high-res people have made just that very point. They said the Agassiz people don't understand statistics. And if they look at their arrival directions, and these are the Agassiz arrival directions, they think they can rule out above 10 to the 19.5 electron volts any evidence of point sources in their high-res data. And they did a combined analysis of both the high-res and Agassiz data, and this is the distribution they got. And they claim that at the, at some statistically significant level, they rule out point sources in a total of, there it is, it's 57 Agassiz results, Agassiz events above that energy. And the number of events depends on what energy cutoff you use. But they had 57 Agassiz events, 27 high-res events. They think there are no point sources, that these are compatible with chance arrival directions. So there's certainly disagreement. There are events at extraordinary energies. It's interesting that these happen at all. We don't know where they come from. We're not sure of the fluxes exactly. Are there some beyond the GZK cutoff or not? The arrival direction is rather isotropic, but maybe there are clusters, if Agassiz is right. The major problem is that the flux is so darn low, 1 per square kilometer per century per steradian. So the idea is to build a much larger observatory, the Auger project, and to use a hybrid technique, simultaneously using a ground array technique to see the shower front as it hits fluorescence technique at night. So for 10% of the time, the events are seen with both techniques at the same time. And if we're interested in looking for an isotropies, ideally we would have two observatories, one in Argentina in the south and one in Colorado in the north. And as the Earth rotates, we would have coverage of the entire celestial sphere. So this one is under construction. This one is being proposed now. So the hybrid observatory is shown here. This is one of the detectors we've been deploying in Argentina. It's a big plastic tank filled with water. There are 3 photomultiplier tubes looking down into the volume of water. And when the shower front comes and hits the ground, the Cherenkov light generated inside the tank bounces around, which is detected by the phototubes. The information is all processed locally. There's a solar panel for powering up the electronics locally. And there's an antenna there that communicates with a tower, which in this case is located on top of that hill. And then there's another large tower here that communicates back to the central lab. This is a hybrid observatory, and this is one of the detectors out in the field. And on that hill back there is a fluorescence detector that looks out over the desert ground above the ground array. So here's a photograph that shows 1, 2, 3, 4, and a fifth over here detectors in a row. These detectors are 1.5 kilometers apart, so it's very hard to take meaningful photographs because the next one is not going to be visible. It's off to the side. And they're designed to be sort of a color to blend with the desert environment so we don't make too much of an impact locally. This is being deployed in Argentina. at the foothill of the Andes in a sparsely populated region full of cows. And this is the fluorescence detector I just showed. Inside each of these six bays is a lens with corrector rings around it to improve the aperture. Light coming in when the night is dark, there is no moon, and it's clear, not too many clouds. The shutter is open. Light from a distant shower comes in, is focused by a spherical mirror onto an array of photomultiplier tubes for a camera with 144 pixels. So I said it's kind of hard to get meaningful pictures of the OJ Observatory. So what I did is to try and get a feeling for what's going on, I built a model in Google Earth of the OJ Observatory. And let me actually switch to the model and see if we can get that to work. So here's the Earth. And we're going to now rotate to the OJ Observatory in Argentina. So the Andes run here. And just at the foothill near Santiago, Chile, here's the OJ Observatory. Now, each of these circles represents a surface detector that's currently been deployed. So we're still working to deploy detectors in some of these areas here. And the town of Malargue, Argentina, the little town, is where we have the support buildings and equipment. Tanks are prepared here prior to deployment in the field. We have one nitrogen fluorescence detector here, one under construction up here, and one over here. So we have four of them looking out over the volume of the array. And we can zoom in on some of these things.
So over how large an area?
So this is about 50 kilometers here. The total surface area is 1,600 square kilometers. It's the size of Rhode Island. And this is one giant instrument. So we could focus on, say, the central region here near Malargue, where we have built buildings, an assembly building, an office building, and you'll see the central communication tower that communicates with all the detectors in the field. So here's the office building, here's the assembly building, here's the telecommunication tower. And if we change the field of view to look at this from above, you'll see that when this photograph was taken of the aerial photography, there were a number of tanks in the backyard that hadn't been deployed yet, waiting to go out in the field. We can look at some of the fluorescence buildings. Let's go to the Los Leones fluorescence building. We're going to rotate out to go to this particular hill here, on top of which we built this building that looks out over the array. And you see the tanks out in the distance. And here's this fluorescence building, another tower that communicates with all the tanks in the field. And this is one of an array of calibration buildings we have for shooting laser-like pulses into the sky so that we can excite the nitrogen in known ways and we can calibrate our scintillation or fluorescence response. We can also look at some of the detectors out in the field. Here's a tank. Each of our tank is named. This is El Cortaderal. So they're named by local school children in Argentina. They have contests for naming our tanks. And you see that this particular tank was deployed at the time that the photograph was taken. And it's a problem because we have rivers running through the site. There's a farm right here. And our tank is in a region that's prone to flooding. So we've had a number of problems with floods in that area. These are the kinds of realities we have to live with. So we've been deploying this over an area of 1,600 square kilometers, 52 kilometers shown here, 1,600 detector stations, each 1.5 kilometers apart. We've deployed, this is the full array as it will look when it's completed. You saw that we're working in this area now, and four fluorescence telescopes. The total exposure so far for OJ is shown here. This is aperture for various detectors, Fly's Eye, which is the pioneering version of high-res. AGASA shown here, high-res shown here. And with OJ, we have been accumulating data as the detector was being built. We now have an accumulated exposure comparable to what high-res has done totally. And as time goes, we will be dominating the statistics for events collected in the field. Some of you may have heard of the Telescope Array Project. This is a Japanese project in Utah that will reuse some of the high-res detectors to do a careful study of systematics of the two reconstructions with surface detectors and with fluorescence detectors. But this is it's about a quarter the size of one OJ observatory, one OJ South, the OJ South observatory. So the acceptance is reduced compared to OJ. So this is focused mostly on understanding the details of reconstructions. And to go beyond what OJ is doing, it would require something in space, perhaps the, something like a Yuzu observatory that would look at the dark side of the Earth to look for air showers from above. But that's very uncertain. The future of that is very uncertain. So for now, it looks like OJ will be the ultimate in making the science, doing the science measurements at these energies. We've been collecting events. I'm out of time, so let me skip very quickly over that. You see that when a shower hits the ground, it lights up a number of detectors. We can fit the profile of the amount of activity as a function of distance from shower core. Some events are seen in coincidence with the ground array and with the fluorescence detectors. And you can see the shower profile through the sky at night when there is no moon and the night is clear. And we sometimes see monocular events, sometimes we see binocular events, and this was a triocular event that was seen by the fluorescence detector here, the fluorescence detector here, and the fluorescence detector here as well. So we have very good control of systematics by making multiple measurements. We do a hybrid reconstruction where we use signals of the fluorescence detectors and signals of the ground, and we have a technique using a laser in the middle of the array to simulate an air shower. And we can reconstruct the event as if it were a fluorescence event alone, or if it's a hybrid event. And the hybrid resolution in blue is so much better than the fluorescence event alone that it really brings a lot of power to bear. Combining the two techniques, the hybrid technique is the way to do it. So combining all of this, and after running for an agreed period of about a year and a half, we decided to do an analysis that was first shown last summer of signals within 60 degrees of the zenith with an average fiducial area of 600 square kilometers, 660, with a full trigger efficiency above 3 times 10 to the 18 electron volts, corresponding to this amount of exposure. We collected 3,525 events, and this is the spectrum we ended up with. So this is the number of events at these energies as a function of energy. You see that we have events right up to 10 to the 20th eV. We have a couple that even exceeded that energy, but there were a few problems with these events, like the shower core, for example, fell out just outside the array. The event was probably good, but we had made a series of very careful cuts to have only gold-plated events for this. So we believe there are some events beyond this energy, but they don't appear yet in this plot. And to compare the measurements with still large systematic uncertainties built into either of the reconstruction techniques, we can compare the Auger measurements in black with the high-res measurements in red and the Agassa measurements in blue. And one is tempted to jump to conclusions and to say that Auger is confirming high-res, maybe there will be a cutoff, and Agassa was wrong. However, bear in mind that the uncertainties are still large in the energy reconstruction. This is again rescaled by some power of the energy, so that folds into that. So there are large uncertainties everywhere. And we are also in the process of making new measurements of the fluorescence yield of the atmosphere when a shower comes through. And it looks likely at this point, based on these preliminary results we have obtained, a fraction of the Auger collaboration has obtained, that our points are going to move up in energy a little bit to perhaps somewhere in between the two. So this is not the end result yet, but this is where we've gotten to. The uncertainties are still large. This is a project that's slated to run for perhaps as long as 20 years. So this is the first hint of the kind of science we'll be able to do. We also looked at those 3,000 events or so and conducted a search for previously reported point sources. I said that Agassa thought they saw an excess near the galactic center of events. And another observatory in Australia, Sugar, had also reported an excess, not at the galactic center, but near the galactic center. So we looked at our arrival directions, and we conducted an analysis using a filter based on the Sugar energy resolution, or using a filter based on Agassa energy resolution, or using a filter optimized for the Auger energy resolution. And we saw no evidence of any excess near the galactic center. If Agassa had been right, and they had only a third of the statistics that we had, we should have seen a 7.5 excess if Agassa's reported excess had been correct. We observed 1,155 events within that region. We expected 1,160, so it's complete agreement. There is no hint of an excess as far as we are concerned there.
How accurate are the directions measured for an individual event?
Well, this is roughly an estimate of the uncertainty of the arrival direction. That's how that filter is determined. And if we do a sugar-like search, we should have seen a 2.9 sigma excess. We saw 144 compared to 150 expected, again, completely compatible with no excess at all. We looked at the galactic plane, the supergalactic plane, no excess anywhere, disappointingly. We conducted a preliminary point source search at different energies. We saw no evidence of any point sources so far. So it would be great if we started seeing arrival directions in the sky that seem to be sources of these objects. So far, nothing. But maybe that's exciting. If we see no arrival directions that are preferred at all, maybe something exotic is taking place, like the topological defect decays. We'll have to wait and see. So to conclude, with the CREAM experiment, we have obtained a large, high-quality data set. With the two flights so far, we expect to have collected a total of about 200 carbon nuclei, above 1 TeV per nucleon. So we multiply by 12 for the carbon, so that gives you an idea of the energy there is about 10 TeV per particle. The trigger aperture covered so far is about 86 meters squared to radian days, far in excess of any previous direct experiment. The system would have functioned well for 100 days. We ran this experiment for 42 days, but this was detected. Well, this detector was built to fly on the NASA ultra-long duration balloons that are being developed. They still don't exist, but NASA is trying to push a new balloon technology. And if and when they get this to work, CREAM is slated to be the first detector to fly on this new kind of balloon. So we will have the world's best boron to carbon measurement, up to about 500 GeV per nucleon, the best spectra up to 900 TeV, the best direct exploration of the need. The CREAM 3 payload I mentioned is in the works. We are building it now. It's not going to be ready in time for this year's Antarctic campaign. We're planning on going back next year. And who knows, by then we may have the new kinds of balloons available to us. And at the highest energies, the origin of the particles is still a complete mystery. There are large increases in data that are required. Also, fresh particle physics input. The models that are used for reconstructing the energies make certain assumptions, and there needs to be a lot more work done there. There are new promising experimental efforts, chiefly the Auger Observatory in Argentina. We are still proposing the site in Colorado. That's not been approved yet. We will have the definitive measurement of the ultra-high energy spectrum. We will definitely have sensitivity to point sources, if any such exist. Some limited sensitivity to composition by looking at differences in the shower signals that could be originating from protons or iron nuclei. There's also the potential for identifying neutrino-induced events as nearly horizontal showers instead of nearly vertical showers. And we have the first Auger results that are just coming out now. That is a hint of things to come. Thank you very much.
Basically, you're using the atmosphere as the main detector. Is there any chance of actually seeing the primary?
No, not at these energies. Not unless you have a very patient graduate student who's willing to wait 200 years for thesis.
It's a matter of the fluxes.
So it's a matter of the fluxes. There's no choice in the matter. You have to resort to indirect techniques.
So if I came to you, I suggest this could actually be the dark matter. So very low gamma factor with a very high energy particle.
There wouldn't be very many of them. We know how many of them there are. They're quite rare. So how do you get enough of them to account for the known dark matter density? That would be a problem, I think.
Do you know if they're yours are charged?
Do we know if they are charged? But what was that?
The things you're primary is, do you know if they have a charge? Or
we don't at these energies. We assume they do because the lower energy cosmic rays are all nuclei. So, but we have, I haven't had a chance to show this, we have a limit on how many of them could be gamma rays. And if they were not charged, then they would point back to their source. And you would think that by now we would have seen clusters of sources of these objects. So likely they are charged and their arrival direction will be smeared. But if they are relatively local, cosmologically speaking, they should still point back within a few degrees to their source. That's the hope.
So both Hi-Rez and Agassa have seen sort of higher energies than theory would predict, but only one of them managed to see past this GCK.
Well, if it turns out, based on the recent measurements that are still in progress and not yet published of the fluorescence yield, that the Hi-Rez reconstructions are incorrect, and if they are redone, it's likely that their spectrum will move up. And now they would start seeing more events beyond 10 to 20th EV. So it's interesting, and we would have to understand how they get to us. Mm-hmm. And there's a mystery there, which is nice.
Mm-hmm. So when you reconstruct the energy at Auger,
yes.
using the fluorescent
right.
approach, and then you reconstruct the energy using the tanks, do you get the same energy?
Yes, we do to a large extent. And I have a plot that I can show you of one versus the other. They all scatter with some spread around a line. So we know that they agree on average, but there is, at the lower energies, a departure from agreement that we're worrying about. The energies I showed here, however, are the result of a hybrid reconstruction. So we use the fluorescence technique for extracting the energy, but we constrain the fluorescence reconstruction to agree with the fact that the shower core is known to have hit near certain tanks. So that limits the timing of the signals in a way that improves the energy reconstruction. And it does affect the fluorescence reconstruction significantly. So the energies are largely derived from the fluorescence measurement, but constrained by the surface detector signal. So the two techniques are brought to bear on this measurement.
How do the abundances of those light elements compare with what you actually find in the CREAM experiment for your high?
The light elements at the lower energies, around 1 dB.
More on carbon.
Yeah, it looks like they are in line with reasonable extrapolations. If you look at, I don't know if I'm going to find a slide, but maybe we can talk privately afterwards. But if you look at the extrapolation from the lower energies of the measurements, they are compatible with a simple extrapolation of what was being what was taking place at the lower energies. What we're looking for is a departure from that trend that would be the signature of the break in the spectrum of the rigidity dependent end of the acceleration mechanism.
But you don't see it.
We don't see it yet, but it will require the additional flights to push the statistics to the higher energies that we don't have yet with the very first flight.
Can you say a little more about this shockwave acceleration mechanism, give a little more detail on how it's supposed to work?
Right, so you have this shockwave that propagates through an unshocked medium. And what you have to have is a particle being swept up by the shockwave, get behind the shock front, get turbulently scattered around, reemerge from that shock region, and re-enter a number of times. And on average, you gain a fraction of the energy after, on average, after the encounters. So it's an accrual process of traveling back and forth across the shock front a number of times. And it is, astrophysically, there have been shocks observed with things like the solar corona. They have low energy acceleration is taking place universally in the cosmos at a variety of environments. And this is pushing these ideas to extreme environments like supernovae, or in the case of the highest energy cosmic rays, things like pulsar accretion disks and such, where you could have a standing shock wave as matter accretes onto a small, highly magnetized object.
Are you saying this has been confirmed to some extent at lower energies?
There have been at lower energies indirect evidence for this mechanism to be taking place in other astrophysical settings. So it's a well-established mechanism in astrophysical sites for accelerating particles. But as you go up in energy, it becomes more challenging to make that mechanism work.
So it's not really the same mechanism. It's peculiar that this more or less a straight line fits the whole range of energy.
That
suggests some different kind of origin.
Well, yes, there is this sort of cosmic concordance of the normalization of these different lines. And it has people scratching their heads. And there are people who say, frankly, this is all bull. You have to go to more exotic ideas, like plasma pinches taking place in various settings to locally produce an extremely enhanced acceleration field. And the jury is still out there, and it's still an area of active theoretical investigation.
But it's a logarithmic scale, and everything is linear on a logarithmic scale.
Well, if you looked at gamma ray and photon spectra, there would be a lot more structure on this. For the charged particles, things are smooth to an incredible extent.
You could have two lines, but they wouldn't have to coincide.
That's right. So it's interesting that it works out that way. And the one spectral feature is that knee. And even that we don't understand. There's only one of them. So
with Auger North, you'll have better statistics, and you'll have the all-spec coverage.
And we're also getting ambitious. We're proposing an even bigger array in the north.
Okay.
what's the point of building exactly the same thing in the north that we did in the south? So we're talking about 4,000 square kilometers, or maybe a square mile grid, because it's the US, it has to be miles. That's because roads are a mile apart, so it helps with deploying things.
Do you also gain in terms of cross correlations between the two?
Well, the main gain is, well, obviously, you double the statistics, or you do better than doubling the statistics. That's always desirable. The main effect is having exposure to the entire sky. So if there are sources out there, we'd like to be able to point them out and see them. And you do that by being able to see everywhere. That would be the main effect. I mentioned very briefly neutrinos as possibly being detectable through horizontal air showers. Even in the best of cases, if neutrinos exist at these entropies, they would be produced as GZK byproducts, GZK interaction byproducts. And we calculate that if some of them are tau neutrinos interacting in the soil underneath the instrument and maybe coming out of the ground at a shallow angle, that maximizes our aperture to these things. And even in this best of circumstances, we might have only a few events per year in one Auger array. So doubling of that might make the neutrino signal all of a sudden detectable, whereas before it was really marginal. So there's a number of reasons for building this. It's expensive, though, and it requires a large international effort. There are 19 countries involved in Auger South, and largely the same group of countries, unfortunately not Canada so far, involved in the potential Auger North.
Unfortunately, people are trying it in the room for something at 3:30, so maybe I'll cut the questions off here. But Stefan's here the rest of the day, and he's here tomorrow morning, and also we'll be having dinner at Bistro if people want to join us for dinner as well. So it's, please do bring your questions along, and I'm sure Stefan will be happy to answer. So why don't we thank him one more time for.